French programming for children ages 4 to 12. Campers participate in crafts, games, experiments, field trips, and activities with special weekly guests. ASSA staff ensures a safe, packed summer with memories that'll last a lifetime. Spots are filling up fast, so register now at assascamps.ca.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy. A watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At last week's City Council meeting on Tuesday, June 3rd, Council reviewed a report outlining the relevant changes proposed through controversial provincial bills 5 and 17 and their anticipated impacts on Kingston. Both construction-focused bills officially made their way through Queen's Park last week. Bill 5, the Protect Ontario by Unleashing Our Economy Act, proposes amendments to several pieces of legislation, including the Ontario Heritage Act and a repeal of the Endangered Species Act. Council already voted unanimously to oppose Bill 5 in their May 23rd meeting, with the concern that waiting for this information report from staff would not leave enough time for MPs and relevant parties to receive the motion and take action. Chief concerns revolved around environmental impact, special economic zones that would supersede the municipality's planning power in selected areas, and opposition from Indigenous communities. Bill 17, Protect Ontario by Building Faster and Smarter Act, was put forward with the objective of speeding up the construction of new homes and infrastructure and proposes changes to streamline development approvals. This includes changes to the Building Code Act, Development Charges Act, and the Planning Act, among other legislation. The 16-page report from city staff outlined some of the key changes that will impact the city. Bill 17 will allow developers a longer time frame to pay development charges, DCs, which are used by the city to fund other infrastructure-related projects. The changes surrounding DCs may cause cash flow issues, according to the report, leading to additional financing costs for capital projects, increased administrative costs, and delays in capital project timing. Bill 17 would also give the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing the authority to decide which studies can be included in a complete building application, meaning municipalities could no longer require information like sun-shadow studies, wind studies, urban design studies, and lighting studies. According to the report, these assessments are often essential for evaluating whether a proposed development is compatible with the proposed area. While the report attempts to provide a detailed overview of the potential impacts on Kingston, the city's chief administrative officer, Lainey Hurdle, in responding to questions from council, acknowledged that the full implications of the legislation remain uncertain.
The current bill, there are no direct financial implications. There is strictly a delay in terms of when the payments have to be made, as well as I believe there might be an impact on interest. We expect, though, that there may be implications in the future, because when you look at the bill, there are still some elements that are to come forward at a later time. I think it will require more investigation in terms of what exactly this will look like. So I appreciate that the bill, Bill 17, has actually received approval, but there are still, I think, a number of things that need to come through in terms of regulations.
Councillor Connie Glenn summed up the bulk of concerns expressed by council members regarding the future impact of Bills 5 and 17 on the city's plans.
My take on it then is that it puts all of this significantly at risk, because instead of those mechanisms being more secure, we are being placed again in, and I think the best wording that described our relationship to the other levels of government was said at FCM this past weekend, that we are treated as a child. So unfortunately, I think we're going to find ourselves in a very awkward situation trying to balance these things, and that unfortunately it's not going to have the intended impact of really speeding building.
Really, I just didn't want to keep going around and around in circles on this issue. So I'm just looking for more.
That's out of order.
That's out of order. That's a dad joke. I have five kids.
That was Councillor Ryan Boehm speaking at Tuesday night's council meeting as he introduced a motion seeking more information about how the city decides when and where to build roundabouts. Last month, council approved the first major roundabout in Councillor Boehm's district in Kingston's East End to be built at a cost of $3 million. That decision came in place of installing traffic signals, which would have cost $1 million. Now, Councillor Boehm is asking for a deeper look into whether more roundabouts could be feasible around the city. His motion notes that roundabouts are becoming increasingly common in other municipalities as an alternative to traffic signals. They offer several potential benefits, including improved traffic flow, reduced emissions, slower vehicle speeds, and fewer severe collisions, contributing to both safety and sustainability goals. However, the motion also acknowledges challenges. Roundabouts require more space than traditional intersections, which can impact construction costs, property acquisition, and the surrounding area. With unanimous support from council, city staff have now been directed to prepare a report by early 2026, detailing the city's traffic control policies and outlining how roundabouts are evaluated for new and reconstructed intersections.
Short story long. Essentially, this is just looking for more information. Roundabouts definitely do have their place. We don't seem to be building a lot of them. So it was just in a conversation with staff of like to try to figure out like where that holdup may be. Is it a planning thing? Is it a money thing? Basically, it's more just trying to get more information. It does sound like going forward, we're probably going to start to see more of them in appropriate places. But this was more just to try to sort of understand from top, from beginning to end, how that whole evaluation process works. Obviously, we see them popping up in many places around us, but kind of want to understand how and when and why, and hopefully we will see more of them being built here. So that's as simple as it is. It's just looking for more information on that.
For CFRC News, this has been Christina Laurie, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, June 9th, daytime high of 19 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation throughout the day. That 70% chance of rain stays consistent overnight as the temperature drops to a low of 15. Tuesday, June 10th, daytime high of 20 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud and a 40% chance of precipitation throughout the day. It's going to be a clear, beautiful night, dropping down to 13. Wednesday, June 11th, daytime high of 22 degrees and a low possibility of rainy weather in the forecast, just a 30% chance of precipitation, dropping down to 16 overnight. Thursday, June 12th, a daytime high of 22 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 11 overnight. Moving towards Father's Day weekend, Friday, June 13th, daytime high of 21 degrees, a mix of sun and cloud, going back down to 11 overnight. Saturday, June 14th, a high of 19 with cloudy conditions. Sunday, June 15th, staying consistent in that 18 to 20 degree range with a 40% chance of precipitation. Monday, June 16th, going to be a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 22, and it's going to be beautiful and sunny. Tuesday, June 15th, more sunny weather in the forecast. Daytime high of 23 with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for the temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel during the following periods. For the summer, the dates of closure are June 8th, June 15th, June 22nd, June 29th, July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th. It will be closed 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. The fall closure dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th, and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, and the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on those dates. Now for this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Aberdeen Street William 2 Earl is closed until June 11th for paving operations. Berry Street Queen 2 Colborne closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cassidy Street Montreal to Maple is closed until June 20th as part of the ongoing intersection improvements of Montreal and John Counter. Earl Street Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Lakeshore Boulevard, front to Joreen, closed until June 13th to rehabilitate the existing sanitary system. Pine Street, Division 2 Cherry, closed June 9th from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. for sewer relining. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria, closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett, is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. And Wortman Avenue, Lakeshore to Lakeland Point, is closed until June 13th to rehabilitate the existing sanitary system.
Now let's take a look at some community events happening around town this week. On Wednesday, Kingston Pride and drag artist Bewitched are hosting a drag makeup workshop at the Central Branch of the Kingston Frontenac Public Library from 4 to 7 p.m., open to anyone 14 and up. Just remember to bring your own makeup as supplies won't be provided. On Thursday, start the day with Stories in the Square at Springer Market Square from 10:30 to 11 a.m. Hosted by the Public Library, this free event features stories, songs, and sunshine. That evening, Art Noise is running Life Drawing from 6 to 8 p.m. with a live male model, and the drop-in cost is just $10. Over at Domino Theater, the dark comedic play Decrepitude Blues starts at 7:30 p.m. Tickets range from $10 to $20 and are available at the door. Folks, this show will be running until June 21st. Then from 8:30 to 10:30 p.m., head to Hotel Wolf Island for a special night of storytelling with Dave Pomfret and Martin Verrill. This event is free and celebrates the launch of Pomfret's debut novel, Lily. On Friday, join QLab Community for Craft Jam at BSC Skate Shop and Coffee Bar from 6 to 9 p.m. For $8, you'll get paint supplies and access to a cozy art night on the patio, plus drinks and mac and cheese. And if you're in the mood for singing, karaoke runs from 9 p.m. to 12:30 a.m. at The Buckle. On Saturday, get excited for some great Pride events. The Kingston Pride Community Fair runs from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Confederation Park, featuring local artisans, community groups, and live performances. The Pride Parade kicks off at noon from the Memorial Center and it winds its way downtown. Then at night, an evening of Pride lights up Confederation Park from 7 to 10 p.m. with a drag show featuring Perla from Canada's Drag Race and a stacked local lineup. Also on Saturday, YGK Craft Beer Fest returns to Fort Henry from 12 to 8 p.m. and general admission is $20. The Kings Court Street Festival runs from 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. with a neighborhood parade, barbecue, and live jazz. Island Talks runs at Hotel Wolf Island from 11:15 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. with author Sarah Selecki. Or folks can catch Sapphic Delights at Something in the Water from 8 to midnight with drag, games, and dancing. Tickets are $20 in advance or $25 at the door. At 10 p.m., Time Out Bar and Bistro hosts a free 19-plus drag show with Becca Blake, Tiffany Morgan, and Dixie Landers. And finally, the Forever Gala in celebration of Kingston's Animal Rescue's 15th anniversary. It's happening at the Isabel Bader Center from 5 to 11:30 p.m., with tickets available for $175 each or $325 per pair. On Sunday, the Kingston Community Brain Tumor Walk takes place at Breakwater Park. Registration starts at 10 a.m. and the walk kicks off at 11. Or check out the Brock Street Block Party, running from 12 to 4 p.m. with street shopping, games, live music, and a roaming bar between King and Wellington. And Tonight, Sunday evening, Alina Ballerina's Summer Gala hits the Kingston Grand Theater at 5:30 p.m. with performances in jazz, tap, ballet, and more. Tickets are just over $39 for adults and $33 for youth. Got a community event you'd like us to share? Head to cfrc.ca and let us know. Hi folks, it's CFRC's Ellie Sturton, and coming up are some great live music events you can check out around town this week. On Wednesday, it's Wings and Tunes at the Covan with Sean McCullough and friends from 5 to 8 p.m. Grab some wings and join the open mic and maybe win a prize. Blues fans can catch Jeff Dunn live at Time Out Bar and Bistro from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. But if you're up for something louder, Tumble's Lost in Light tour hits Hotel Wolf Island from 8:30 to 10:30 p.m. with Montreal guests Mooch. Tickets are $15 to $20. On Thursday, grab your guitar for Country Open Mic with Clem Chesterfield at the RCHA from 7 to 10 p.m. with a $5 cover. Or head to the Cove Inn to see the award-winning country blues legend Morgan Davis play a special solo set from 5 to 8 p.m. with a $15 cover at the door. Check out Who's Here, live at Grace United Church in Gananoque from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Tickets range from $20 to $25 and raise funds for the church's efforts. The Thousand Island Country Fest kicks off on Thursday at Happy Green Acres Campground with Abby Stewart at 7 p.m. and Lemon Cash at 9. Tickets are $39 per day or $99 for the full weekend. On Friday, the Sittin' Ducks bring classic rock and country to the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m., $5 for non-members. The Thousand Island Country Fest continues with Paige Rutledge, Dean James, and John Norrand on the bill. At 7:30 p.m., award-winning organist Nathan Evakian performs at Kingston Korean Church. Just call ahead to reserve tickets. And the Grit and Grind Fest launches on the mansion's patio at 5 p.m. with a full lineup of heavy music. Tickets are just $30 in advance. Folks can also catch Purple Diamonds at Time Out Bar and Bistro from 6 to 8 p.m. and fast forward to Friday playing at Wharf and Feather from 6 to 9 p.m. On Saturday, the Spectators play the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m. with a $5 cover for non-members. And the Thousand Islands Country Fest wraps up with music all day at Happy Green Acres featuring Lucas Oak, Mackenzie Leigh Meyer, and David Boyd James, closing it out at 9 p.m. Over at the Hotel Wolf Island, Bryce Clifford and Brother Briscoe play from 6 to 9 p.m. And at Spearhead Brewery, Mauricio Montesinos performs Latin guitar from 2 to 5 p.m. Stick around at Spearhead Brewery for a fundraiser from 7 to 10 p.m. supporting Kingston's Rosewell rehearsal space. It features the Killdeers, Clem Chesterfield, and the Bon Evans Band. That one is $15 or pay what you can. And on Sunday, Gerald McGrath brings indie rock to Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5 p.m. And at Time Out Bar and Bistro, Landon Martin and John McClurg perform from 3 to 6 p.m. Got a local concert or music event you want us to share on air? Head to cfrc.ca and let us know.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by local EDM artist Yuta Monique. The new track called Is This Mind Control showcases Yuta Monique's signature blend of high-energy beats and infectious melodies. The song also captures the spirit of the genre, inviting listeners to move, connect, and get lost in the rhythm. Drawing inspiration from the values of EDM culture, including peace, love, unity, and respect, Yuta Monique's song celebrates the way music brings people of all ages, backgrounds, and identities together in a shared experience of joy and unity. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Is This Mind Control by Yuta Monique on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Forever.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single called Rush Hour, produced and performed by two graduating Queen's Music students, including CFRC alum Richard Hu, a.k.a. Forged Reins, and David Yee, a.k.a. Sheep in Wolf's Clothing. The new single combines the strengths of both artists in an upbeat acid jazz track in 7+6/4 time. They welcome you to experience the culmination of their academic journeys in this electrifying collaboration. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Rush Hour by Forged Reins and Sheep in Wolf's Clothing on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 269. And on the program this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation that I had with Amsterdam-based author and community activist Jarmo, who's recently worked on a project called Take Back Mochem. That is a historical name for Amsterdam, and it's a Yiddish name for the city, and it really speaks to this idea historically of Amsterdam being a gathering place for communities that were displaced, for marginalized experiences, a cultural center. Of course, until today, Amsterdam really continues to project itself in the world as a space of creative expression, of being open to alternative lifestyles, to nightlife, to LGBTQ communities, and many other experiences. But the city's been hit hard with gentrification, and I think it's important to hear a contemporary activist voice about these intersecting points of crisis around displacement and gentrification in Amsterdam today. This book project is an important window into those voices and experiences, and I wanted to speak with Jarmo about the book project and his reflections on Amsterdam today. So here's our conversation for Free City Radio. Often when we think about social movement organizing histories in Amsterdam, it is a city where there's a whole period of time that's celebrated around building collective occupations and squatting. In recent years, there's been a network of activists, contemporary activists, that have been both drawing from this collective history of the city that goes back generations in a lot of ways, but also looks at the contemporary. And so, of course, Amsterdam's a city that has experienced extreme gentrification, but in recent years, there's been quite a few squat actions. You have put together a publication that sort of visits some of these discussions and debates. In it, you have transcribed a lot of interviews with younger organizers and activists from different groups, feminist, anarchist collectives, squatting organizations, migrant justice groups. So it's an interesting sort of window into this moment of contemporary activism in Amsterdam. So first, could you just introduce yourself and then after that speak about this initiative, this publication that you did, and introduce it and say why you did it at this time. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks. So my name is Jarmo. I'm from Amsterdam, born and raised here, so I'm Dutch. I'm a writer and an activist. Been involved with different social movements over the last 10 years, I would say. And over the last couple of years, that has mostly had to do with squatting, the squatting movement in Amsterdam, the housing struggle more generally. So I was part of a squatting collective called Mochem Kraakt. I'm saying was because the collective doesn't really exist as such anymore. It's, I guess, transformed more into a network than a collective in a strict sense. But we did, towards the end of the COVID lockdowns, we did a couple of squatting actions. It was around the time that, at least in the Netherlands and in Amsterdam, the housing problem became a big topic on the political agenda. It's basically, we have a massive housing crisis in the whole country, but particularly in Amsterdam, housing is basically unaffordable. That's the bottom line. A lot of reasons for it, mostly capitalism, to keep it short, but it's a massive issue. People just can't find a home. Around the time I became active in the housing movement, to call it that, this was it was on people's radar. It was a politicized problem, which I know. Yeah. Anyways, but we figured, a group of people that I knew we figured that just doing protests or petitioning politicians or whatever, I mean, that's not really a way to get anything done. Like, change usually requires more like radical actions, I would say. And then in Amsterdam, we have this long tradition of squatting as a tactic, as a social movement, with a lot of resources, so to speak, in that sense. And then we figured it's going to have to be a squatting action that will like bring real attention to this and that will put pressure on politicians or people that are in charge. So that's how I got involved. And then we decided to do some very, like, so to speak, sort of high profile, very visible actions, which at that time wasn't really common. I guess we'll get into that a bit later. And I guess our point was to just raise as much attention as we could. And we did that by squatting and doing it like very much in the public eye. Yeah, and after a while, I mean, we were definitely not the only ones taking action in that way. There were a lot of other actions going on, a lot of other groups, activists that were in different ways involved in. And I guess I would call it in general this fight to reclaim the city. You know, the right to the city, that whole concept. You know, a lot of people were involved in that. And we figured it was time to place a spotlight on them, or basically on us, on the movement. And that's how we figured that it would be interesting to make a publication around that. And that became the book.
So you, Jarmo, you bring up a very key moment, which is sort of coming out of the lockdowns and a lot of the sort of systemic questions that came up during this time and sort of systemic critiques on inequality and access to the city. So going just back to that sort of moment and why squatting actions were important for, let's say, younger community organizers and activists in Amsterdam at that time, maybe could you like give us a bit of a picture as to why and what you were all talking about right at that moment?
Yeah, sure. I'll try. It's kind of, I guess, I mean, you mentioned it before. It's like, the squatting movement is used to be huge in Amsterdam. It's had really like a massive impact on the city as it is now. Like, it was like the heydays of the movement were in the 70s and in the 80s, and then it continued up until the 90s and the early 2000s, and it was really, really massive. There were tens of thousands of people that were part of that movement. They were living in squats, and they were very, or not everybody, but like they were very political. Of course, you know, it wasn't just a means of providing housing for people that couldn't afford it. They enabled, I think, a lot of very, very productive encounters and interactions on a lot of topics, you know, and like all of it, of course, based on some form of anarchism or let's say self-organization. But it had a lot, I mean, there was a lot of crossover, I think, with feminist movement, anti-racist movement back in the day. I mean, you know, like all sorts of anti-capitalisms going on. And there was a strong connection, or like it was also like a very important like sort of breeding ground. Like it was very fertile soil also for culture, you know, for cultural production, for alternative culture, alternative places. So that means that in Amsterdam, like actually a lot of the you know, like most famous, most renowned cultural venues have their roots in the squatting movement. They used to be squatted places, and then they just became like, I don't know, you know, like more mainstream musical venues, but that's where they came from. So same goes for like a lot of social housing. You know, like the squatting movement was able to put so much pressure on the government back then that, you know, like to give them something back, they just provided a lot of affordable housing for regular people. So impact has been massive.
Just to interject, I mean, like really important cultural spaces, and there's many, but like OT301, the Oki Cultural Center, these sort of like really world known spaces for cinema and music were originally squats.
Yes, even Paradiso or the Melkweg, you know, like they were squatted like in the 60s or in the 70s already. So I think that's quite extraordinary. I don't know. I don't know every city in the world, but I think this is quite characteristic. I think of Amsterdam, maybe mostly because, let's say the presence of these places has been ongoing for decades now. You know, it's not just, I mean, of like, yeah, these places still exist. And with that, like some of the political culture out of which they arose. And I think that's really just, I think that's very important, like in general for radical politics or alternative culture or social movements to be able to reproduce, you know, like once you lose these places, it's very difficult to connect. It's difficult to connect back through history, so to speak, to tap into that tradition that once existed, like, it's very difficult to get that back once the chain is broken, so to speak. And I think in Amsterdam, we got really close, or, I mean, our opponents, our enemies, you know, the politicians, the capitalists, the gentrifiers, you know, I think they got quite close to breaking the chain, but they never really succeeded, you know, not entirely, in the sense that, you know, like at least on the radical left, like this memory of the squatting movement and what it meant and what it has done, like was preserved, which means that it was like, in a way, like a repertoire, a sort of an action repertoire and a culture also that we could still tap into. And I think that's the crucial thing, you know, like we weren't the first ones to think, you know, oh, we're gonna squat because we want to do something radical. No, like there were like, That's a thing that we could do, or could even could imagine, because it was already part of our political imaginary. And there were a lot of people that were very experienced and a lot older than we were, you know, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s even, that could help us do that, could help us pull it off. So I think the only thing that we did differently with the collective that I was part of was that we were like extremely visible and loud about our action, because like the major change in the Netherlands, like in legislation, is that squatting was banned, legalized in 2010, which is maybe strange to hear for people who are not aware of our particular context in the Netherlands, but just to be clear, like squatting wasn't actually illegal. That made it easier, of course, for the movement to grow back, like way back when, but like it wasn't illegal. There were like some constraints, some legal, like, you know, but it wasn't as an activity as such, it wasn't illegal until 2010, then it was made illegal. And that's really when the movement suffered its biggest blow. And it's also like to be, you know, like, to be clear, like it hasn't really recovered since then. Like used to be way bigger than it is now. But another major consequence, I think, of that ban was that squatters became way more cautious, and I think they retreated a little bit into their own scene, where they felt a little bit more safe, because it just became more risky to do squatting actions. Which also meant that there were less, or there were fewer like high profile big actions that drew people into the movement. So the movement started to shrink. And then what we did, that was the major difference, is that we were like, you know, like this is not going to help us in the end, not in the long run, you know, if we're going to like hide or just do small actions all the time, like nobody's going to know, nobody's going to see why this matters, why this is important. So we're like, fuck it. You know, chances are we're going to get evicted very soon, but we're just going to squat a huge building in the middle of the center of the city of Amsterdam. We're going to put a huge banner on it. We're going to go on, you know, on Instagram, on TikTok. And this shit was like not done in the movement. But we have to get our message out, or nobody's going to know what we're up to. And I think that gamble paid off, in the sense that, I think we made squatting, or like maybe radical politics, or direct action, less secretive and more accessible to people that weren't already part of that movement. And that was really our philosophy. Like, this movement has to grow, otherwise it's going to die. But for that to happen, we need more people, but then they need to understand what we're doing, which means that we have to be visible, we have to be clear, we have to be accessible, and we cannot just speak the same old anarcho, lingo that only we understand.
Well, Jarmo, in this publication you've worked on, I understand there's a number of people involved. It goes into that. It goes into how things happened, even on a technical level, on a physical level, but also some of the ideas and the debates. And I always really, I'm excited when I see people who are involved in social movement action, taking the time to reflect and write down and also speak to each other to document sort of the debates that go into social activism. And so you've done that for this sort of like moment that you're describing. So talk a little bit more about that process and why it was important.
The thing is that there are a lot of books and like history books or whatnot about squatting in the Netherlands. Generally there's a lot of books about radical politics. There's a lot of theory going around. People like reflect on activists. It's a common thing. Like, we're not the first to do it, obviously. But what we figured was that what still lacks maybe a little bit is to really start from the perspective of activists, like whatever they're doing, instead of like just reflecting on what they're doing, and that was really the guiding principle of this book. We're like, we have to find a way of letting this movement speak for itself, rather than adding more, theoretical discourse on radical politics. So that was really our guiding principle in making this book, which is why we worked together with, it's a very collective, very collaborative effort, like there was a sort of editorial team of which I was part, but there were really like dozens and dozens of people involved in making this book. And there were mostly collectives, activists, very few of them were professional writers. And we really wanted to like capture the moment and the movement as it was. So that's why it's not just about squatting, but it's also about, it's about it's about queer emancipation in Amsterdam. It's about ecological issues. It's about the unhoused and their struggle. It's about illegalized migrants and how they live in Amsterdam, how they try to fight for their rights. And we really wanted to put that all together, but without, let's say, one overarching perspective or theoretical discourse or theory. The only thing that we did want to add, or I don't know, like have as a premise was, there had to be something that glued all these different people or activities together. And to us, there was the ride to the city. I guess that's where we started. That's, I think, the only thing that we really added, so to speak, to what people were already doing. And to be a bit more specific, I guess, like the book is called Take Back Mokum, and Mokum is the nickname of Amsterdam, and we try to take that word back a little bit, but give it a new meaning. So, like in our context, it's kind of a bit of a nostalgic concept, like it's like the traditional people would use that word for Amsterdam. But what it means originally, it's a Yiddish word. It basically means place or city, but it has this connotation of refuge or safe haven, a place where the people that fled from persecution or oppression elsewhere could go and find a home, despite the fact that they were not from that place. They came from somewhere else, but they could still make it their home because it was a refuge. And that's the meaning that we wanted to give back to this word of Mokum. And then we used that as a way to imagine the city, if it was really ours, you know, like if you take back the city, if you reclaim the city, reclaim space, like, what does that mean? It cannot be a nationalistic thing. It cannot be a proprietary thing. It cannot have to do, you know, it cannot be a possessive thing. We have to think about a way that, you know, of thinking about urban space or a social space or whatever society or the world in general is something shared. And the word we came up with for that was mokum, in the meaning of refuge or safe haven. And that's how we tried to conceptualize this social struggle for reclaiming our city.
I found it really cool that in this book you have all these transcriptions of the conversations, and I also can feel in some of the conversations there's a little bit of tension that you're like highlighting inside of the movement too, which I felt was healthy. For example, the interview with the Feminist Anarchist Collective and how that relates to the larger sort of squatting movement, and then also some of the debates in the squatting movement around thinking about the layers of privilege in terms of like non-status people or people who are facing like the framework of being quote-unquote illegal, etc. Yeah, if you have any comments about that, but also if you can describe the book, like it's basically, I find it's an interesting project also because I very much can feel that it's coming from this activist context, right? It's not going through sort of like a major institutional publisher, et cetera.
The book, I mean, it consists of different genres, so to speak. It's not, so there's a bunch of interviews in there, of course. But there's also essays, there's some more sort of academically inflected pieces, not a lot because we wanted to keep that to a minimum, but we wanted to make space for that too. There's a comic in there, a lot of pictures, you know, so it's like, and it's quite a lot. It's like, how many pages is it? 350 pages, something like that. So it's quite a lot. We just wanted it to be like really full. Like we wanted it to be sort of overflowing with you know, with ideas and examples and practices, basically. So yeah, we wanted to include as much in it as we could, and also not stick to just one genre. So it's a bit all over the place, but I hope in a nice way. And yeah, it's also true that we didn't want to, I don't know, like shy away from from the conflicts that are there too, you know, not everybody agrees on everything, and also the fact that that we don't really have any answers or solutions. We try to highlight that in the beginning too. Like that's not what we're really after, you know. Like it's not like we think that we know what has to be done. You know, we're not Leninist also in that way. Only thing that we can do is sort of provide examples of practices and explore the possibilities that, you know, that are inherent to them. And then what we can do is try to, you know, like work together more closely and build solidarity and then see what comes from that. But yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing. It's kind of like we were making a book about, you know, like autonomous and you know, like largely anarchist practices. And then we figured it would also be a bit strange to gather all that material and then just give it to a publishing house and then just like run through, you know, like sort of finding alternatives. It's not, I mean, again, like it's not about the ideas as such or only, like it's really about the practices, but it involves the production process, you know. It's a bit, there's a contradiction in there, I think, if you're just gonna gather a bunch of radical ideas and then have some kind of company like profit from that. You know, even if it's a publishing house, you know, like there are worse companies than that, but still. So yeah, we just made the book ourselves. So we designed it, we just did all the editing, whatever, like we didn't have any sort of external help in that sense. And then, yeah, we basically published it ourselves. We just worked together with a small publishing house. It's a Dutch publishing house that kind of specializes in like, let's say, radical theory, but they only helped us with the distribution, nothing else. We did I mean, we just made the book ourselves, did the promotion to the extent that we did. and they just helped us with the distribution, like to get it in bookshops. We just thought that actually we came to realize during the process that this is actually also something that we should have more autonomy in, you know, like the infrastructure of spreading our own ideas. And then after a while, after the book came out, like the Dutch version, the first version, we kind of decided that, you know, we should set up our own publishing house. Yeah. So that's what we did. And then our biggest project was first to translate this book into English so that it became, you know, like available to more people. And now we're just still collectively working on other projects all about activism practices, radical practices in Amsterdam, but also internationally. And we're trying to create our own infrastructure to, amplify these voices, and distribute it ourselves, and trying to do activism in and as publishing. That's kind of what we're trying now.
Jarmo, thanks for the conversation today.
Sure.
That was a conversation with community organizer Jarmo, based in Amsterdam. He is part of a collective called Mochum Krat, which you heard about. Collective of squatters, activists, and artists. They have recently published a book project, Take Back Mochrum. Look it up. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. You can find us weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays, 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Friday at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
Hey, Kingston families, looking for an unforgettable summer adventure for your kids? Look no further than ASSIS Camps right on Queen's University campus. ASSIS Camps offers English and French programming for children ages 4 to 12. Campers participate in crafts, games, experiments, field trips, and activities with